Okay, so I think this would be a good point to just talk very briefly. I mean, in the last transcript, we talked about the formation of a polymer community in the 1940s. You said at one point that you felt that you were working with physical chemists rather than polymer chemists. Then, you know, more or less one day you woke up and realised that you were in polymer chemistry.
I think that's true, yes.
Okay, so we're now in the 1960s. We've talked about the starting of a complete new journal for polymer chemistry.
No question.
I mean, probably the 1960s were probably the heyday of American polymer chemistry in particular, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the period when the Americans were still far, far ahead of everyone else.
Yeah.
The Germans probably could do that. But, what were your impressions of that period? I mean, was it a happy period? The community, do you think?
I think so. Yes, I don't know how to expand on that. I attended Gordon conferences whenever I could, and the ACS meetings, and there was always seemed to be quite a lot going on, even though I wasn't contributing as much in the way of, you know, having a research stable anymore.
Yeah.
Well, I had postdocs right along, and then when the graduate program came, I've had a few excellent ones. And finally, a theoretician whom I consider second only to Florey amongst my students, and that's Mark Mansfield,
right.
now at MMI.
See, one person said to me, and I can't remember who it was now, but one person said to me that he was always a little bit disappointed at the way the Gordon conferences developed, because back in the 1950s, early 1950s, they were very intimate. Mm. Not very small number of people went to them, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
Whereas by the late 1960s, I think they were inviting a much larger number of people to the conferences, so you lost that kind of think tank, you know, sort of workshop aspect.
That's undoubtedly true, and I think it's the result of the money becoming available and the feeling that attendance at these meetings was worthwhile as a natural expansion. And of course, polymer physics, the Gordon conference was created largely, one of the people who worked very hard on that was a fellow named Robert S. Marvin, who was a rheologist at the National Bureau of Standards, and John Huffman was there at the time. Those two had a great deal to do with starting the Gordon Conference on Polymer Physics. I can't remember the date of the first one of those anymore. You would know that, but that broke up what used to be just polymers, then polymer physics, and of course there are others. There are now one on water-soluble polymers, there's biopolymers and all that. Well, in the middle 50s, though, the people didn't have travel budgets like that anymore. When I was chairman of the Gordon Conference on Polymers, this was in the summer of 1954, the total budget I had to make available to speakers for travel expenses was $600.
Mm.
And I wasn't encouraged in any way. I mean, there was no, the companies were supporting it anyhow, as you know, the whole idea. So the idea of going to companies and getting them to promise more money or to promise to schedule visiting speakers from abroad, simply nobody did it in those days. Tobolsky had been my predecessor as chairman, and I think Ray Fuss the year before that. In any case, I did sort of what they did, and I brought G.V. Schultz to America, possibly for his only visit, and used 500 of my $600 on Schultz. But he was a success in terms of he was a legendary figure from the Staudinger era in the 30s, and one of the real founders of polymer physical chemistry, along with Kuhn in Europe. And he came, and we even got him into a softball game. He hadn't the slightest idea what was going on, but we made him hit the ball once and got him on base, you know, and made him score a run. He remembered that for many years.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
But so I suppose one problem that the polymer scientific community had in the 1960s was one of success. I mean, you know, the numbers, I don't think the figures are in there actually, but the numbers must have grown enormously in the 1960s.
Yes, although the growth was mainly in industry. By then, I think academic departments of chemistry were becoming indifferent to polymer chemistry as distinct from the more fundamental things that I mentioned, which were inevitable because of those advances. I mean, the whole business of spectroscopy without the laser, where would it be today? And how enormously detailed and successful it is. And nuclear magnetic resonance has been, when Herb Gutowski, and I forget whose colleague was, wrote an annual reviews article in NMR, they called it an evergreen.
Right.
And right they are. It's still yielding new tricks. So, polymer science developed. I have a feeling that it's sort of repeating or mimicking the history of metallurgy.
Right.
Which was all in chemistry departments and some in physics departments for a long time, and eventually had enough science plus applied science to form its own discipline.
Right.
With both pros and cons to that.
Right.
And eventually the chemical engineers saw that polymer science rightfully belonged partly to them, and of course material scientists have often now call themselves departments of material science rather than just metallurgy.
That's right. Well, in fact, my impression is that in a way, polymer chemistry or polymer science is somewhat being subsumed into material science, which has a much broader remit.
Well, my research grant for the last decade or so came from not the Division of Chemistry of NSF, but from the Division of Material Science, Norbert Bicalis, and he supported a lot of
Well, where you see that, for example, is in the Royal College of Chemistry, which has never had a division of polymer chemistry, It's now creating a division of material science.
Which is doing that?
The Royal Society of Chemistry.
Royal Society, right? With another journal, I suspect.
Yeah,
they're just as we have the Journal of Materials Research now. I haven't really paid much attention to it. It's over in the engineering library. It's a few blocks away, and Hildebrand's rule is, I think, that the interaction with the journal is of the inverse fourth power of the distance from your office.
But do you think the conversion of polymer science into material science is going to be a good or a bad thing for the study of polymers?
Both. They'll learn from people who work with non-polymeric materials, but perhaps the cross-fertilization from chemistry and physics research of other kinds will necessarily decrease. I can't help thinking that, the size of the effort is so much greater now than it was when I was young. I sometimes don't regret being older. It would be so much harder to start off nowadays.
Yeah.
More competition, much more to learn, et cetera, et cetera. The computers and modern instruments mean that research can be produced so much faster. I have a almost respectable total of almost 200 papers now, that's not a very high rate of production over a 40-odd-year span, 50-year span now, come in matter of fact. It's not. And today, it would not be adequate to tenure in most university departments.
Amazing.
Sure. Of course, Lars Onsager only published 80 papers over his life.
Yeah.
But if you count quality... And of count all the things he solved that he put in the drawer and never wrote up.
What sort of work were you doing in the 1970s? I mean, there were no particular papers which you highlighted. One of the things I did notice about the 1970s is the increasing number of what appear to be Japanese students coming to Dartmouth.
Well, one particular man, Keizo Matsuo, came.
He was one of the people.
He came as a grad student, got his doctorate, and then stayed on as my research assistant for almost 8 more years. Generally, it's sort of 1 year at a time. So, Keizo, isn't it time for you to look for something else now? No, I'd like to stay another year. Well, the experimental program that was carried out was in a large respect due to him. For example, I even got back into polymerization. There's a couple of papers on vinylidene chloride polymerization. Uh-huh. I was really pleased with that one because he carried it out. He and a couple of undergraduates who helped. Because the monomer had been around for a long time, and again, there wasn't a solvent for the polymer under conditions where you could do proper homogeneous reaction kinetics, and eventually Wessling at Dow found some, and we quickly did the kinetics. It was kind of fun to get back into that. No, there were also some theoretical things. Yeah, but the other Japanese, Yamakawa, came on a sabbatical year.
Okay.
Outstanding theoretical polymer scientist in Japan, Hiromi Yamakawa, the author of the book called Modern Theory of Polymer Solutions.
Okay.
A prodigious worker, a real workaholic, but extremely good mathematician. And he's still producing absolutely first-rate stuff. And We did some work on semi-flexible chain statistics while he was there, still being used a bit. And then Wilensky was another super postdoc I had. He came from Fixman.
Okay.
And he unfortunately didn't get an academic job at the time. Later, he's with a consulting firm in Andover, Massachusetts, called Physical Sciences Incorporated, PSI or something. He's done very good work on fuel cells and more recently on colloidal stuff. But I would have liked to see him a professor. He's a good teacher, too.
Another name that came up a few times in your 1970 papers was G. Tanaka.
Genzo Tanaka, yes, right. A Yamakawa student who came over and worked for a while. He stayed long enough to get, you might say, off the Japanese track. He wasn't a member of a pyramid anywhere, and he couldn't get back on, so he's still in the United States. He's finally got his green card, and he's working for Goodrich out in Brecksville, between Akron and Cleveland.
Right.
What he's doing is the sort of thing that Biosim does, computer software, inventing polymer properties and correlations and so on, telling synthetic people what to try next and so on.
How did you find working with the Japanese? I mean, did you find that they approached problems differently from Americans, or...?
Well, mainly in terms of the conversations that go with it. No, I mean, in the laboratory, Matsuo is without doubt the most careful chemical worker I've ever had. Amongst the theoreticians, Miyake, then Kurata, Miyake, Yamakawa, Chikahisa, Tanaka, they're all, very skilled mathematicians, very neat and very industrious. The problem is in discussing problems as they develop, because they don't want to suggest to their teacher that he ever is wrong. I had a hell of a job having these people tell me, oh no, you're crazy, that's the wrong thing to go. They would tend to say, oh yes, I eventually learned that when they said, well, maybe, that meant, oh, you're absolutely full of it. It's just completely wrong.
Right. It's kind of misunderstood. I mean, my impression is that the Japanese are doing very well at polymer science now.
That's mine, too.
I mean, yeah. But they're possibly even in danger of overtaking the United States.
Well, I'm not enough of a synthetic polymer chemist to be able to say that, but they certainly seem to be publishing a lot of first-rate stuff in that. And as to the physical polymer theory, the really, I would say, of course, revolutionary ideas came from Desjardins and his school, and from physics from a different background. The Japanese have not, on the whole, gone into that very heavily.
No.
Yamakawa, for example, hasn't, but he's doing some very good stuff. I don't know what to say about the...
What about the rest of your... I mean, is there any other aspects of your work in the 1970s that you think might be worth mentioning?
Well, I wanted to say that I also got a big... I should have mentioned Alan Jones. It says Alan Anthony Jones, because there are two Alan A. Joneses. Professor at Clark University, NMR guy. He came from Wisconsin, and he knew enough NMR, and I knew enough polymers, so we made a very good team on interpreting chain dynamics for polymers in solution with NMR methods using the 60 megahertz machine that was good enough for doing fluorine research at 56 megahertz, and did a lot of that with fluoropolymers and some others. But so I was very grateful for that collaboration, and that's when we got started on these olefin sulfones, which I'm still interested in. But then another big boost came from my last sabbatical. I went to Freiburg.
Right. I took an archer about that.
And I've forgotten, I want to mention the previous one, because that's where Koenigsfeld comes in.
Okay.
But so what should we do it in historical order?
Okay, you go on.
Ron Koenigsfeld, new pianist, composer, and polymer thermodynamicist, came to visit me after a meeting in the States in 67 on polymer characterization. He was working for DSM, and he wrote and asked if he could come up and visit me at Dartmouth. But I had written one teeny-leeny bit of a paper in which I had derived the critical conditions for a polydispersed fluoride organ system, which hadn't been done elsewhere, and he wanted to meet me. But we discovered when he was having dinner at our house that we both like music and so on, and during the course of that evening, when he confessed that he composed, I said, well, why don't you write something for the two of us, because we were playing four hands by then, about polymer molecules. Mm-hmm. He said, well, I'll think about it, but I haven't much time. Mm-hmm. A couple of years later, he had the time, because he was in hospital for about a month. I can't remember whether it was when he lost his finger or another time. Anyhow, he composed a suite of three pieces, and we played them at the IUPAC meeting in Leiden in 1970. That was the beginning of the polymer music suite, which now has six movements. But on the polymer thermal theme, I sort of had a dormant interest in that. I decided I'd go to Holland for my next sabbatical, and DSM gave me a place to sit, and I worked with Ron on some attempts at shoring up what you'd call mean field thermodynamic theory of polymer solutions. We were moderately successful at the time. We also decided we'd write a book, which to this day doesn't exist.
Okay.
You want to read that?
Well,
yeah, there's a book on phase equilibrium and polymer solutions, which was conceived in 1972, has not yet appeared.
Okay.
And there are to be three authors now. Koenigsfeld's former student, Eric Nies from Eindhoven, is supposed to be a third collaborator. There's been an awful lot of work. I thought that the definitive thing was practically ready. Oxford Press is agreeing to do it.
Right.
And fall of 87, when I was in Japan for a few weeks, I finished what I thought was the definitive work, but it hasn't appeared yet. Ron keeps dragging his feet, wants to redraw some polymer phase diagrams mainly. It's a textbook. It's not a bloody treatise, but he keeps wanting to put new things in. And he's also had a great deal of, well, personal intrusion, which needn't concern us here, but it means that he hasn't been able to put in the time. But it's in his hands, awaiting, I hope. I mean, the last time I saw him, we pounded the table with each other and agreed that the Oxford Press would have everything by July of 1992. So far, he hasn't disappointed me, but I hear rumors that he's gotten into some other thing again. I don't know. We'll see. But that's been, you know, in other words, thermodynamics was, oh God, at MIT when I did my studies, and I enjoyed polymer thermodynamics from the moment I read Flory's and Huggins's papers and everything, but getting back into it through Ron has been fun, and then very recently I'm back in it again in another way, like that. Anyhow, well, I hope that book does come out before we all depart for other places.
But coming back to Firebug for a minute, how did you end up?
That comes later. Koenigsfeld was 72, Freiburg was 78. Yeah, but let's go to Freiburg. I wanted to go there because now at last I wanted to go to Germany. I had gotten acquainted with Walter Borchardt at a few meetings, and I knew we could enjoy talking solution properties there. But there was also a fellow doing NMR called Wolfram Grunsky, and I thought I would do more polymer NMR while there. Well, when I got there, it turned out that Borchardt had just been really overwhelmingly interested in dynamic light scattering, which is then still relatively new, time-dependent light scattering, intensity fluctuation light scattering, whatever you want to call it, quasi-elastic light scattering. He had some theoretical problems in that, and Grunsky was very busy and by nature very retiring, and he didn't sort of especially push me or welcome me in. I don't mean to say he was unfriendly, quite the contrary, but no. In the event, I dived into the quasi-elastic light scattering business, and the papers that Borchardt and I wrote there were based on that, and then his student Manfred Schmidt got one of these Theodor Linen fellowships from the Humboldt Foundation and asked if I had the NSF money to complete the stipend. It's a bilateral affair, and I said, sure, come on over. So Manfred came, and we did some more work in that area. Yeah. Schmidt has now just gone to Bayreuth as a professor after some years in Mainz at the Max Planck.
So what did you do? I mean, I noticed, in fact, about the last paper that you highlighted was one that was evidently done when you own fiber.
Yes, right.
The quasi-elastic.
Yes, right.
Perhaps you'd like to talk a bit, you know, relate that to your time. And
Well, it was another natural extension of being interested in the motions of chain molecules, of Brownian motion theory of chain molecules, but there was some interesting mathematics to be done, and I'm proud that I solved the problem that had just a pure mathematical problem that eluded several previous workers in the area. It's not mentioned as such in there, but it's just one of the things in there. That's kind of fun to do something like that.
What about your co-author on that paper? Can you tell us anything about him? Your co-author.
Co-author, who's that? Borchardt?
Yeah.
Remarkable. Well, he's a professor in Freiburg. He's not one of the directors of the institute. I guess he's what's called an extraordinary professor. He came from East Germany, where he was a boy during the Second War. Came to Freiburg after a year at another university, maybe Frankfurt, and ended up working with Frau Husemann, a former Staudinger student who had succeeded Staudinger as director of that thing, and he worked on the solution properties of cellulose derivatives.
Okay.
But he was, before that, trained really as a physicist. He'd taken a bachelor's degree, I think, in nuclear physics, so he had a more mathematical background than the other polymer chemists around, he published a lot of good work on solution properties.
Mm-hmm. Do you get on well with him yourself?
Very much. During the sabbatical, he was quite ill. He had a heart problem, a heart valve problem, and he had to spend, more than half of the time I was there in hospital, and I had to take his lectures in polymer physical chemistry in German, which I was able to do with the help of the students who knew enough of the words that failed me to make it go. Kanto could have done it, but Kanto was himself off on sabbatical, and then when Borchardt suddenly took sick, why, I was the only other person in the Institute who could have done it.
I did.
I have a nice letter from the dean of the University of Freiburg thanking me for having stepped in and done this.
Did you have a good time there?
Wonderful, yes.
Did you enjoy your time?
Yes, there were several cousins still alive. My favorite one just died a few weeks ago at age 81. But yes, they were still in the Stuttgart area. But we lived outside of Freiburg in a small village. The Black Forest was right outside the door. Cross-country skiing in the winter, hiking in the fall, and had a marvelous time. Enjoyed really embracing the German culture when, you know, the Nazi business was gone, and essentially, as far as one could tell, and the young people, well, they knew more than is sometimes believed, and they certainly didn't like it, and they were ashamed of it and resolved that it wouldn't happen again. So I did enjoy everything about that visit in Germany, and I traveled around quite a lot. I lectured in a lot of places during that time. Konstanz and Heidelberg and Zurich and Eisenhower. Strasbourg, of course, that wasn't far away, less than an hour over to Strasbourg to the friends over there. So
but when you came back from Germany, you in fact basically retired, didn't you? Because you retired in
19- Well, I was at that time, 65 was the
Monday degree.
Yes, and so I became Professor Emeritus in 79, having been already permitted to take a sabbatical in my last regular year, something that's not regular, as you can imagine. But it was already clear that I wanted to keep working for a while, and in fact my colleagues asked me to work three-quarter time with the dean's consent and everything. So for a few years I taught a three-quarter load, then it became a half, and it's now down to 8%. I'm giving 10 lectures this year.
Not bad.
All right.
12 years after it.
That's right.
But perhaps you could, you know, just say a little bit about your so-called retirement activities. I mean, it seems to me that you have remained fairly productive during your retirement, and I dare say you probably have more time to do other things as well. What have you been up to in the last
year? Not enough other things. The editing has become an increasing chore because of the volume of manuscripts coming, even though we're up to a total of 7 editors now, 6 associate editors and Winslow as chief editor of Macromolecules, why we each seem to have more manuscripts. All you need to do is look at the size of the journal. And we do our best to keep out junk. Still, they keep coming, you know. You have to consider them at least briefly. That's one thing. For the rest of it, as long as the NSF for a while was willing to give me a modest research grant, and I was willing to have a postdoc or two, I was able to do that. Klaus Huber was another Theodor Linnen fellow who came just a few years ago. So I was another Freiburg. They did both Borchardt students, Schmidt and then Huber, who came from Borchardt to me for a postdoc year.
Is there any kind of regular link between Freiburg and Dartmouth now?
No.
Or is it just a purely informal thing?
No. What there is between Dartmouth and West Germany is a professorship that's now been endowed by an American donor, a man by called Harris, but it's the Dartmouth, it was called the Dartmouth West Germany Professorship. I imagine it's just now. People are invited for terms, one hopes at least 2 weeks, but sometimes some of the political scientists who have come have appeared for only 2 days and gone off. But they are invited to come and give lectures. We had Helmut Ringsdorf last year. He's a friend of mine, an organic polymer chemist from Mainz. You probably know him too, an old Staudinger product. Helmut came and gave us 6 lectures on his work on essentially mimicking of biomembranes and things like that with synthetic polymers, plus electron line tasting.
Let's stop there.